This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us now to discuss institutional oppression and how it affects different social identity groups are Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Cincinnati, Malik Matthew, who recently wrote an article for CityBeat about the role of Black Lives Matter in criminal justice reform efforts. Professor in the UC School of Planning, Dr. David Verity, who teaches housing systems, planning theories, theories of urban spatial structure, social justice and the city, and urban studies. Associate Provost for Diversity and Inclusion at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Robin Martin, and Assistant Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Chinook Sastry, who is interested in culture-centered health approaches to social change. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Robin, did I get your title wrong?
Yes, I'm the assistant professor at the College of Education.
Okay, assistant professor at the College of Education.
That was my former position.
Okay.
Thanks.
My apologies for getting that wrong. Let me jot that down real quick. As we start this conversation, though, how do you define institutional oppression? What exactly is that, Malik?
Well, when we talk about institutional oppression, we're talking about structures that exist in society that affect people's lives in many different ways. We're talking about things like education, criminal justice system, the religion, many different entities that we kind of think of as existing on their own. I'm kind of uncomfortable with the differentiation between institutional oppression and, I guess, individualistic, because we kind of treat it as though institutional comes from the heavens or something like that. But, you know, this is a feedback loop. So it actually starts with intent. You know, it's not that one day we woke up and, you know, by some random chance these inequalities existed. Intent really led to creating some of these structures. And then from there, we were able to see them perpetuate. So the institution, for example, of education, we had inequalities that were desirable at some point in society's history, and we created a structure around that. We had desirable residential segregation and created a structure around that. You know, so there's some question about whether or not these things are still desirable, but the structure still exists.
And David, how do you feel about the term itself, institutional oppression?
Well, as I mentioned to Mark, I think the use of the term institutional oppression is a conversation stopper. It's an overly vague term. It's politically charged. And to me, it ignores the role of individuals and individual responsibility. Because if we do something bad, we could always say, it's the institution.
Right,
blame it on the big institution. So when I prepared for today's session, I thought of specific issues and specific problems, particularly related to my expertise, which is in housing and neighborhood development. And so I would prefer not to spend a lot of time on definitions and get into specific issues. Mm-hmm.
But I also think it's important, and Malik touched on this earlier, as we think about institutional oppression, embedded in that is the individual responsibility. So I don't think one exists without the other, number one. And number two, I think just because it makes people, because it may not be politically correct or it makes people feel uncomfortable, that it should be a stop the conversation, because in fact, I actually think that is what the very definition of oppression is, right? Is to stop the conversation because you no longer want to hear what may or may not be your reality or in line with what we consider to be aka social norms.
Well, yeah, and I tend to look at it as it's such a big term, as David was saying, that when you hear it, it does almost stop you from saying, how do we deal with it? It makes you say, how do we deal with this? Because if it's institutional, it's entrenched, how do you fight something like that?
Well, institutions can be altered. Intent built them. One of the reasons why I think it's important to acknowledge that a lot of the inequalities we experience today are, in fact, operating at institutional level is because when you speak to the individual level, what you get is, I don't hold personal bias and therefore I'm not accountable. Whereas, you know, as I mentioned in the article, apathy typically works just as well because these processes are already in motion, and so they need to be interrupted. But they can be interrupted. We just need to know that we operate with intent in order to interrupt them.
So, David, you were talking about how you want to look at specific instances, things that, that specifically does. Let's start with housing, for example. What are some of the specific examples?
Okay. But I wanted to add on to both points.
Go right ahead.
In terms of institutional oppression, because it's usually not defined. And some of the people, particularly sociologists, who use the term, but in the back of their minds, implicit, is changing the institution of government or the economic institutions that we're living under. So when they're talking about institutional oppression, well, they may mean they're oppressed by a capitalist system and they're in favor of a different system. And my comment is usually, what system are you in favor of? Are you so someone who gets involved in such a discussion, a Bernie Sanders type who works within a democratic socialist framework, or someone who says, well, we have to change our capitalist system to a communist system, which obviously doesn't work too well. So, but yeah, in terms of your question, I have a list here, and so not to hog the time, I'll mention the first three. The first is physical problems of housing, which of course have decreased over this, well, since 1900. And second, that the main problem has become affordability. And the third, in terms of racial and ethnic issues, the fact that levels of racial segregation and racial prejudice have gone down, although they're still at unfortunately high levels, they've gone down. And the big issue at the policy level and in academia is income segregation or socioeconomic segregation. But I have other items, but that could be the start for a discussion.
Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure in what ways are you referring to and exactly about what has gone down, and particularly the racial segregation part as it relates even to housing. I mean, our communities are far more segregated today than I think they were.
No, that's absolutely not true.
Okay, so
the levels of indices, the sociologists who spend their time studying segregation have developed since the 1950s, indices of segregation, and these indices of segregation are used in this country and around the world. And there's been a uniform decrease in levels of racial segregation. In addition, the number of racially integrated neighborhoods has increased as well. So that's what I'm referring to. And thirdly, when the U.S. Department of HUD funds surveys where they use what's called paired testing to find out whether people are more prejudiced, overt levels of segregation have dropped, and the more informal levels of segregation have become more important. But I'd say levels of prejudice, particularly.
But again, you're talking overt levels?
Level, okay. Like knocking on the door for an owner and saying, I'm interested in buying your house, and being turned down as black, that's dropped. Or a landlord, particularly a big landlord, saying, no, we will not take you because you're black. That's far less frequent. But will a small landlord say, I'll call you back? Yes, that thing happens. And too many times.
And so I think you have to do the intersection between not only race, but also class and wealth, right? And so, and then have that conversation around segregation, because it really is about an economics as well. It's not just about proximity of where you live. We live where we can afford to live,
right.
Not based upon my race, generally. If I can live in Indian Hills, I live in Indian Hills. If I can afford to,
That's right. Not,
I am living somewhere else. So that's number one. Number two, I also think it's important when we think about institutions, oppression, we really do need to think about systems that are already in place. And we seem to go, well, let's just forget about that. In some ways, we'll come back to that later on. But the lack of the acknowledgement that there are systems and institutions that were built And on the basis of racism itself, right, I think is a flaw in how we move forward. So we just can't, it's easy to say, well, let's just forget about that and let's just move on. I think you have to take that into account and then find meaningful ways
to move on. Well, I think that's what I was trying to express earlier is the idea that when you phrase it as institutional oppression, it sounds so big that you throw up your hands right. and just yeah. say, well, yeah. what can yeah. you do about it?
Yeah.
Well, I think that when you're talking about institutional oppression, you're talking about systemic pressures that operate on everybody. You know, so mm-hmm. when we talk about race, for example, one of the things that we know from research is that particularly whites tend not to recognize that they have a race. You know, when we talk race issues, they think it includes everyone else. And you'll sometimes hear the polite terms, well, you know, these people are from an ethnic background. Well, everybody's from an ethnic background. But the default never recognizes itself to be that. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about systemic issues, what we need to recognize is that systems put pressure on all members of society who are involved in them. The difference is that if you are in a privileged position, the pressures that are put on you are rewarded with advantage if you meet the expectations of the status. And if you are in a subordinated position, meeting the expectations of your status doesn't actually assure you any type of prosperity whatsoever. It's kind of a no-win situation.
So you're saying privilege is the other side of the coin from oppression? Is that what I hear?
Well, when we say privilege, that term scares people. Mm-hmm. You know, it terrifies people. How can you say I'm privileged? And especially since they kind of think of in an individual way. You know, so one of the benefits of talking about institutions is that we recognize statuses are privileged, not individuals. You know, so individuals are privileged to the degree that they manifest the assumptions of their statuses. And if you ever want to know the difference between privilege of status versus privilege of individual, hold a privileged status and violate the assumptions. This is why we see men typically defending masculinity, because if they don't manifest as masculine men, then they are harped upon. This is why we see people who are from richer backgrounds trying to justify when they get into debates about, you know, supporting the poor. You know, Warren Buffett, why does he care about the poor? You know, there's always some justification that needs to be given there. And we see it also with race. You know? So it's not that anybody in the system ever is entirely free of systemic influence. And in fact, there's huge backlash if you step out of even privileged positions to advocate for the underserved.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and joining us to discuss institutional oppression and how it affects different social identity groups are Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Cincinnati, Malik Matthew, who recently wrote an article for CityBeat about the role of Black Lives Matter in criminal justice reform efforts. Professor in the UC School of Planning, Dr. David Verity, who teaches housing systems, planning theories, theories of urban spatial structure, social justice in the city, and urban studies. Assistant Professor in the College of Education, Dr. Robin Martin. And you can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. I think, David, you wanted to respond to something that Malik was bringing up.
Yes, I think something that Monique was mentioning before. I guess the reaction I have to some of the things that he's saying is I find it interesting in terms of stimulating a conversation, but a lot of things that he says requires a lot more nuance. So, for example, when you talk about institutional racism and the housing market, well, I've done research on how landlords treat Section 8 tenants and how to deal with discrimination with respect to that issue. And one thing that you find is, maybe surprisingly, that the larger landlords and the bigger complexes have training programs to deal with discrimination, and that there is a lower level of discrimination. They work with fair housing groups, and they've achieved improvements which ought to be recognized. On the other hand, there are landlords who we call mom and pop landlords who own maybe four apartments, six apartments. They don't know the laws. They're very uptight about whether what constitutes discrimination. And when the housing authority tries to deal with the issue, it's much harder to involve people like that who often really don't even want to own their properties. So I think in a discussion of institutional racism in the housing market, nuance is required. And the term privilege is an example of a conversation stopper. We could undoubtedly spend an hour talking about what that means and how it applies to different groups. Does it apply to lower-income blacks the same way it applies to middle-income blacks? What about American Indians? What about Asian Americans? As America, I deliberately say American rather than the United States because this applies to Canada too. As America becomes more diverse, we can't think of this as a black, white, or African-American, Caucasian issue. There are lots and lots of groups with many, many different issues, with many unique histories. And unfortunately, we often, particularly in a city like Cincinnati, think it black-white when it, on the West Coast, it's not black-white. Black-white, Hispanic, Asian.
Malik, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah. So one of the things he's talking about is that we have very many different status sets, first of all. You know, so when we talk about intersections, race, class, gender, it's one of the reasons why when we talk about status privilege, you know, the groups that I have the hardest time explaining this to, explaining racial privilege to poor whites and explaining gender privilege to black males. Because they feel subordinated. They feel systemic pressures that are very real. And so they demand to know, how is it that you are telling me I'm privileged? And this is where we step out of the assumptions about individuals and say that the status is what is privileged, not individuals. And you're very right about the black-white dichotomy. It's one of the annoying things actually about some of the social science research is we still operate with this very black-white way of thinking about things, and to the degree that we incorporate other groups, we tend to treat them as honorary black versus honorary white. So Latino Americans, well, we'll put them with the blacks, and then we'll just toss Asians over here with the whites, and the outcome should look similar. Yeah. And they don't, you know. Yeah. And often,
one size does not fit all. It's not a cookie cutter process.
But we do that. We do that as if we can't walk and chew gum. And I'm often amazed about this.
So give ourselves more credit.
So gives ourselves more credit. So when we say Black Lives Matter, it's not in any way to say that white lives doesn't matter, gay lives doesn't matter, anyone else life does not matter. But oftentimes that's exactly what we do. We put it into this kind of comparative, and so we think that when we say oppression, as Malik said earlier, that just only means one group. And in fact, everyone at some level will cry some level of oppression. And that's why I think we have to be careful not to just focus in on the individual, but really think about it as an institution. White people are just impacted by oppression than blacks, Hispanics, and everyone else. And so you think about it from just, then you have to layer on power, then you have to layer on economics, and then you have to layer on a few other things. But there's some level of pressure that we're all kind of feeling at this point. One of the other things, I looked up the definition of oppression, and what I think stops people is this cruel and unjust, this feeling that I am doing something that is insidious on purpose to someone else, and therefore, oh, because I'm a good person, it shuts down the conversation because people do not want to feel like they're not good.
Right. That's not me. I'm not cruel and unjust. It is. It's strong wording. And it's like privilege. I think it is off-putting to a lot of people.
But whether or not you have intent to be cruel doesn't mean that the actions of a collective
themselves
are not cruel.
Yeah.
I think that's a very useful point about being cruel, because we may talk about institutions and we may talk about broad population groups, black, white, or even expand that. But when it comes down to reality, we act upon what's good for our families. So when we make decisions about things like what neighborhood should we live in, should we stay in the city of Cincinnati, should we move into, we're making based on decisions like where is there crime, where are there good schools. And while you might in general say there are issues in society about inequities in schools, that decision is primarily a decision you're going to make based on your own children.
So can I say that? That's a very good point. Although, if you look at it from a statistical data standpoint, that just doesn't bear itself out. You know, what we are reported is that blacks create more crime, or that's what is reported. But when you look at the FBI status or stats, that's just not the case. More whites actually commit more crimes per capita. More whites rape at a higher rate. I mean, and so who goes to jail and what is the media outfits? And so, you know, I looked up some of the white-on-white crimes, and oftentimes we even think about black-on-black crime. 83% of white murders are killed by white-on-white. You have the vast majority of violent crimes committed by whites. And so if you think about it from a purely statistical standpoint, if you make that decision solely based upon not understanding the institution that plays, you would say, then, you know, that I'm not going to live in those neighborhoods. And so, but oftentimes that is not the message or the narrative that has been played. And so we need to acknowledge there are some institutions that are in play that more than likely have a slant on how blacks are portrayed as gang members, as violence, and crime itself.
Well, but also think about, I think I like what he brings to light about decisions. Decisions are made at individual level. And so you make them with restrictions set for you. So when we talk about privileging and when we talk about structure, the structure is what delivers those parameters. So it takes an act of heroism to say, I'm going to put my kid in this school despite the fact that the school is suffering. But why is the school suffering? If we're talking about school funding, why are schools funded the way that they're funded? If we're talking about neighborhood crime, the driving factor in community crime is typically concentrated poverty. It's not race. And when we see that concentrated poverty is accounted for, the race effect, you know, disappears. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about these individual level decisions, we are making individual level decisions with structural parameters set for us. And so when we talk about institutional inequalities, the importance of that is to address those structural parameters that allow people to make these decisions that otherwise, you know, they may make, but there are costs, there are opportunity costs to making them.
Let's talk to Tom in White Oak. And again, you can join us at 513-419-7100. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Just briefly, recently I've had to change physicians. And since this person and I have been together, he's never done a certain test. And it's, you know, it's a PSA test. And I said, are you going to do this? And he says, no. And I said, well, why not? And he says, well, we've kind of figured out that we've been testing so intently for that particular thing that what we've determined.
And Tom, if you could get your question, please.
Okay. There seems to be an ever increasing magnification to the microscope of racism. And that being the case, does it ever go away?
Okay. Thoughts?
I think it's
a tough issue. I mean, we've talked about overt racism.
I would interpret as saying, well, race was not an issue because poverty is more important, that once you control for poverty, some of these things disappear. I think it's more complicated than that, but I wish it would be true that we would, over time, stop seeing all things in terms of a racial prism, but I don't see that in the near term, and I think what's happened over the last year or so, unfortunately, makes me pessimistic.
Hmm. Well, first of all, when we say that race and, you know, race is not the effect, the driving force, it's class. We also have to recognize that these things weren't randomly selected. You know, the interaction between race and class, the overlap between race and class was intentional. And so we're just looking at these effects and figuring out through what avenues we arrive at them. I think it's very dangerous to make that argument, but it's an argument that people often will make. Now, when we talk about the prism of race, I don't think the prism needs to go away. You know, I find it very confusing when people say things to me like, I don't see race or I don't see color. It would be like me telling Robin, you know, the way that we address gender inequality, I don't see you as a woman. Makes no sense. What hits my ears is race matters to me in such a way that I can't get past it unless I ignore this factor. So I don't think that we need to move out of a paradigm where we recognize race and where we think in terms of a racial prism. I do think that what we need to be mindful of is that that prism guides us in ways that it need not guide us. So the biases don't need to follow through with recognizing difference. You know, in my essay, I mentioned left-handedness versus right-handedness, and we no longer think that left-handed people are children of the devil. But we built a society that initially thought that, and the structures exist that perpetuate that. We can very much just account for that without without ignoring. We don't have to say, well, we didn't recognize that you were left-handed.
Malik, you just mentioned that the overlap between poverty and class is intentional. By whom is it intentional? Are you talking about some undefined elite in our society? Are you talking about the president who happens to be black? What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the system that has existed now. The system that exists now never went away. So we, from the start of the United States, had a very racialized structure, much more overt. You know, and so a lot of times people say things like, you know, slavery is over. Yes, it is. But the United States was built on the institution of slavery. It was pervasive through our economy. If you think about how we operate now, all of us here are sitting down with smartphones in our pockets. And we ignore the fact that these smartphones are built by people who are themselves operating in slave-like conditions, because the cost to us is that we don't get to function in our society the way we would like to. So we look at it and we say, oh, what a shame, but are we actually proactively doing anything? No. So this system perpetuates, and until we actually alter that system, their circumstance will remain. So when you ask this question about who put us into this position, who created this circumstance, this was created a long time ago.
I think you start off by saying that a lot of this was like a feedback loop.
Yeah.
A lot of this has just been going on, and it's just
been going on. And so the shortfall of thinking that we change individual ideas and therefore we change outcomes is that we missed the step where we put the ideas into effect to revise the structures. And unless we do that, we're just going to have well-intentioned whack-a-mole games where we keep trying to pull out, okay, there's discrimination here, there's inequality there, let's
And I think that was the caller's point is it's just one of those problems that's it's ingrained. It's tough to deal with.
It's interesting because that was
Can you hold that thought, David? And we'll take a quick break and we'll come back to that. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this afternoon, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Cincinnati, Malik Matthew. Also, from a professor in the UC School of Planning, Dr. David Verity, and assistant professor in the College of Education, Dr. Robin Martin. And you can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. And David, you were going to say something before we went to the break.
Well, let me just say briefly, I get very pessimistic when we talk about, let's say, when the founding fathers had slavery, and we attribute our problems today to slavery, that suggests that we're going to have an ongoing problem into the indefinite futures. And I'm a bit more optimistic than that. But what I wanted to do is shift gears a little bit and to give a case study which indicates the difficulties in trying to reduce levels of segregation, levels of racism, and to bring this all really to reality and to reduce the level of abstraction. I just finished a review of a book called Integrating the Inner City by Robert Chaskin and Mark Joseph, and it's about the Hope 6 program in Chicago. And it's very relevant because we, as we sit here, We're one block literally from City West, which is Cincinnati's Hope Six site. Hope Six was a HUD program which was instituted really to save public housing and to save the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And the notion was that this really dilapidated low-income housing and high-crime communities would be replaced with mixed-income communities. And the mixing of different income levels would help to achieve social mobility among the lower-income groups. It's been carried out in about, well, over 100 cities, some cities a little bit differently than others. Atlanta, all the public housing has been demolished and replaced, which is probably the extreme end. Cincinnati is not that extreme. But I would say that the book is interesting because it's really one of the first ones to actually say, well, what happened in terms of the interaction across class lines and across race lines? And what they found was that, contrary to hopes, there was little evidence that the mixing pushed people towards better working. Second, instead of leading to better understanding between groups, it led to greater tension. It led to greater monitoring of the lower-income groups. This is cross race lines. Greater monitoring of lower-income groups by the middle-class groups and resentment of that monitoring. And after reading this book, I'm pessimistic about whether Hope Six could achieve the lofty goals that it was aimed at achieving. On the other hand, unlike other academics in the field, I don't think we should go, we should have to do nothing. In other words, we shouldn't say, well, it was okay. Public housing in 1990 was okay, and we shouldn't have done anything. I think we needed to do something. We made it an attempt to achieve income mixing, but it didn't achieve the goals that we attempted. And this is part of a broad problem in social policy. We have high hopes for very simple solutions, and they usually are not successful.
Right.
You talked earlier about kind of the time frame, and I think often what is left is we talk about the progress that we've made. But when you go back to the institutional piece, if you think about 400 years of slavery, another 100 years of Jim Crow, and really you're talking about another 50 years in the past 50 years that you've really had some civil rights action. So we're not talking about—
Yeah, we forget that that started in the 1960s.
Absolutely.
And it hasn't been that long ago.
Absolutely. So when we talk about we've come a long way, we talk about it in the concept of those 50 years. What we rarely talk about is that was over 500 years, and that's the institutional oppression that we really are talking about. And that's just not about, it's not a black-white paradigm, that's an economic paradigm, that's a whole lot of paradigms rolled up in one, but that's the institutionalized piece of it. And so, yes, have we made some changes and made some inroads in the last 50 years? That answer is yes. We have a lot, we have obviously a lot further to go.
Let's talk with Frank in Vandalia. Hi, Frank.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. Go right ahead.
I have a question. Prior to the break, Dr. Verity and Dr. Martin seem to have a bit of a disagreement concerning the levels of racism as they rose or they fell since the earlier data were taken. And I'm interested to know, at the time the data was taken, were LGBTQ issues or persons factored into that data? If so, how do you, wouldn't that offset the specific issue of racism, since homosexuality and lesbianism aren't exactly race issues?
Well, I would say that the gender issues were not examined along with race, and I'd say that this is a big issue within the black community. But the two of you could speak more to that than I can, but I would say that this is not limited to the United States, but if you look at South Africa, for example, they had a tremendous problem of initially recognizing the AIDS crisis, which is bigger there than elsewhere. But on the other hand, they've done more in South Africa than anywhere else. So that's where I see the overlap between race and gender, not on housing surveys. There probably have been surveys in particular cities, but I'm not aware of them.
And so someone used the word nuanced earlier today. If you look at the academy itself and even research themselves, you know, that the predominantly mindset of research comes from, the voice comes from predominantly white affluent males, number one. And number two, if you ask the average, you know, white person whether or not race has gotten better, they would say yes. If you ask a lot of African Americans or Hispanics and they say, have the race relations gotten better? Yes, the ways in which we go at it, no one's knocking on your door and saying, this is what I want. But the nuanced piece of it and the way people are feeling may be very, very different if you ask them one-on-one or in a collective in that group. And so it is nuanced. And it's not just about race. It is gender. It is class. It is sex. It is, it's difference of all kinds that people are feeling.
I think all, you know, we have many different axes of inequality in our society. We sometimes fall into this trap of playing oppression Olympics.
Yes.
Which form of inequality is, you know, the most supreme at the moment? Is it race? Is it class? Is it sex? Sexual orientation? Is it gender? Are we talking age? Are we talking religion? And the answer is all of the above. Yes. All of these axes of inequality are operating concurrently. And no individual has just one identity. So all these different status sets, identities are working together to form a status set.
They all come into play in this whole thing,
And, you know, I think that we need to, you know, not allow ourselves to fall into that pattern of let's compete for, you know, who is the most egregiously oppressed.
Right. Well, we've only got about 3 minutes. I want to make sure we got to Jean in Northside because I think she's got a good question here. So, Jean, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've enjoyed listening to this conversation, and I'd just like to say I want to hear more conversations like this that go beyond us people having to be convinced that institutional racism and oppression exists. And there are, you know, my family, we don't need to be convinced. I'm white, but I can recognize it quite easily. And I would just like to ask the panel, you know, what us white folks can do to help to make the problem better for black people in this city and in this country, practical things that we can do to take action to support the black community.
One of the best quotes I've read this week is said, the fact that humanity has to clarify that any lives matter should be concerned enough for all of us. And at the end of the day, I think it is about our core humanity. So it is about when we see any part of our humanity suffering from whatever, whether it's based upon race, sex, as Malik said, you know, we could go into the variety of topics, that is our responsibility as humans in order to step up individually. And we no longer can sit back and say, it's just not me. It's not me. I go to work every day and I do a good job. It really is taking an active and a courageous stance on things that really matter. And how do we move our collective humanity forward?
So don't say it's not my problem. That's it.
And it's not either or. It's not Black Lives Matter or All Lives Matter. It's Black Lives Matter today. They do. White lives matter. All lives matter in that context, but we say it in a way in which we're competing against one against the other. You can't say one without saying the other. And to me, that in itself tears down humanity.
David, quickly, your thoughts?
Well, I agree. And I would just note that we need more conversations like this because what I hear on television and see on television is different from what I just heard with the Lives Matter, it's often a shrill discussion pitting one group against the other. And I'm thrilled to the nuance that's been introduced.
Well, right.
But
I want to be clear.
They're good, they're bad. And I want to be clear.
Black lives, they do matter.
I think
the paradigm that we've set up is that it's always a response to all lives matter. That in itself is oppressive to say it in conjunction with or comparison to.
And if I could say just one last thing, when we talk about operating from positions of privilege, it's very uncomfortable for people. So one of the things we tend to do is find some dimension on which we're disadvantaged and say, well, it's like this. You know, and I've done this myself. When I think about gender inequality, I say, well, it must be like class oppression or like race oppression. No, it's not. It's a different thing. But we have to humble ourselves, you know, before the cause and recognize we're here operating to serve the cause, not necessarily to be the hero of the story.
Thank you, everybody, for joining me this afternoon. Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Cincinnati, Malik Matthew. Professor in the UC School of Planning, Dr. David Verity. And Assistant Professor in the College of Education at UC, Dr. Robin Martin.